It was in the early 1990s when John Anthony West and a Boston University geologist revealed something shocking, their theory that the Great Sphinx of Giza in Egypt showed evidence of rainfall erosion. And why is that so important? Such erosion could only mean that the Sphinx was carved during or before the rains that marked the transition of northern Africa from the last ice age to the present interglacial epoch. And what this all means is that the Sphinx, according to John Anthony West, is much older than what others are predicting and others feel. In a moment, special guest tonight, John Anthony West on Coast to Coast AM. Well, one day I've got to take a trip to Egypt with John Anthony West. He's a writer, scholar, Pythagorean. He's also the author of The Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, The Case for Astrology, as well as consulting editor for the Traveler's Key series. John writes articles, essays, criticism for the New York Times Book Review and others. He won an Emmy Award, that's television, for his 1993 NBC special documentary, The Mystery of the Sphinx, hosted by Charlton Heston. He is the leading authority and proponent of the symbolist school of Egyptology, an alternative interpretation of ancient Egyptian culture. And in addition, John lectures extensively on Egypt, personally leads several in-depth study tours to Egypt every year. He's our special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. It's been too long, John. How are you?
It's been a while, yes.
4 years. I bet so much has changed in 4 years, just your field.
a lot has been not so much change as developed and accrued. The situation vis-a-vis the Sphinx theory and Egypt and the academic establishment remains confrontational, but there are very interesting signs of imminent change in the offing, yes.
John, do you find that every time you go to Egypt, you pick up new information or you get new data that you just didn't have on the previous trip?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. It's a question that comes up on my trips because I lead them, four or five times a year. And one of the things that invariably that's asked, people say, well, don't you get tired of doing this? We go to the same places all the time. And I say, yes, but I haven't had you with me all the time. And I always have, very interesting, because I always have an eclectic group of mostly very knowledgeable people who have expertise across a spectrum of fields, some of them directly, more of them indirectly related to Egypt. And invariably on the trips, discussions pop up and people point out to me things that I hadn't noticed before and things that I've seen 100 times, and somebody asks a question, what about that? And I go, yes, something falls into place. And sometimes those are those are actually quite major discoveries. Sometimes they just add a piece to the puzzle. But yes, so it's continually stimulating, and a bit like a really favorite piece of complex music. No matter how many times you hear it, every time you hear it, you do get something new out of it.
And it always seems to get better, too.
It gets fresher and newer, and certain things get better. For example, the hotels keep getting better, and the food keeps getting better. But it also keeps getting more crowded.
So is it safe out there now, John?
What's safe now?
That's true.
For years, there was this terrible thing that happened back in 97 when they had this massacre at the Hatshepsut Temple. And then the government really cracked down, and the fundamentalists who pulled off that particular caper declared a moratorium on killing tourists because they realized, that depriving Egypt of its main source of income was not going to endear them to the population at large. And the idea was to get the current semi-secular regime out of there and put something more Islamic into place. So that was counterproductive, and plus the crackdown. So for 7 years, nothing happened at all. But then the last couple of years, They've had a couple of minor incidents, relatively minor. People got killed, so how minor can that be? It wasn't minor. For the
especially for them, right?
Yeah, but the people who got killed, it's not minor.
No.
But in terms of numbers, in Cairo itself, just a relatively small events there. But then a couple of the last few years in the Sinai. But this does not seem to be orchestrated, massive terrorist al-Qaeda. I mean, that's a big can of worms in itself of exactly who al-Qaeda is. I'm sure you've had programs on of saying,
absolutely.
Hey, this is, and this is not necessarily, it's conspiracy theory, but who says conspiracies are wrong? That's a standard thing today. Oh, yes, that's conspiracy theory. But, sometimes conspiracy theory is right. Anyway, these seem to be homegrown, disgruntled groups in the Sinai, the Bedouins, who are really angry because people are, because the language, their lands are being taken from them, and they're getting a very bad deal. And this is true. I mean, they're in a tough position, but it doesn't seem to be the kind of long-range, orchestrated, carefully planned stuff that's going on elsewhere. And we don't go to the Sinai. Beyond that, it's hard to say. Even if when things happen, who knows why something hasn't happened here since 9/11? It's a bit amazing to me because it's certainly this stuff about security. It's nonsense. How can anybody secure your local Walmart or high school football stadium or something of that nature? But my own feeling is that until it's civil war, until there's open warfare on the streets, the chances, even if something happens, the chances that you're going to be involved are about the same as being struck by lightning. And people really have these irrational fears. It's a bit like, I use the example all the time, you're driving down the highway, how many times have you gone by a smoking wreck and the ambulances are there and you see that, gee, if 5 minutes, that's a recent accident, if I'd left 5 minutes earlier, could have been me, but it wasn't you. And so you drive on without thinking twice about it. And travel these days is a bit like that. The chances are, I've been there. I've been in Egypt when events, things have happened. I was even in Luxor when that terrible Hatshepsut thing went on.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in the temple. And even, I know people who were in the temple. Even if you were in the temple, there was something like 1,000 people there and 60 or something like that actually did get killed.
Yeah,
even then, your odds are better than 1 in 10 that it's not going to be you. But you don't really want to take those kinds of odds into consideration. But really, the odds that it's you are literally infinitesimal. So I simply don't worry about it. And as a matter of, actually, there's a matter of, more than that, it's a kind of a philosophical attitude, you might say, that if you really want to go someplace or do something, and all of a sudden you're afraid, whoever has made you afraid rules your life.
They have won, exactly.
They have won.
John.
So all of the stuff that's going on in this country now, with the powers that be, pumping up the fear, you might say the fear level, and saying, it's the war against terror. It isn't. I mean, they are fighting the war for terror because they're ensuring that everybody stays terrified. And stupid people stay terrified.
My father, John, was born in Cairo because in the 20s, his family stopped off there, and there he was.
Ah.
And, his place of birth was Cairo. And let me tell you, growing up in Detroit, whenever we went into Canada, because my mother was born near Boston.
Yeah.
And whenever, we drove the shorter way, and that was from Detroit through Canada into Massachusetts.
Right.
And I'm telling you, every time we went over the Ambassador Bridge and he told them where he was born, I mean, they stopped us for 25 minutes, more so then than they do now, as a matter of fact.
Really?
But it has been a special love for me. A region that I have not been to, and he hasn't been there since he was a little kid.
Really?
Yeah. He's 83 years old now, and I still would have loved to have gotten him out there again. But
well, how fit is he?
He's okay. I mean, he's his, the body's willing, and you know, he just he doesn't stay up as late as he used to, and
well,
things like that.
Does he get up early? That's the main thing on my trip.
Exactly. But I've got little pictures of him sitting outside one of the main pyramids,
right,
on a camel, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. It's just it's fascinating, and your work, of course, is something I have followed through the years. So this is a treat for me to talk with you tonight.
Actually, I was wondering, your name Nuri is Islamic, right?
No, I'm Catholic. It is
really?
It's Lebanese.
Oh, Lebanese. Yeah, I mean Nur is light in Arabic.
And it means the light.
Yes, yes. Nur is light in Arabic. Right. Oh, I see. So you're yes, I got you. Okay.
So, anyways, I love that region, and that's one of the reasons I'm so knowledgeable about some of the Middle Eastern things that are going on right now.
Right.
Because I've studied it all my life, and basically born into it as well.
Treat yourself to a trip.
I'm going to do this with you one day. I'll pledge and maybe even do my shows out there for a week.
Well, you could, actually. I think nowadays these such things are possible. And your dad is, you know, people in their 80s come on the trips regularly.
Yeah. You think Zahi would make it easy?
I'm not myself.
You think Zahi would make things easy for us to broadcast out of there? Mr. Hawass?
He might. I'm not sure. I have this new... We'll get into that maybe somewhere along the line. I can get into it now if you like. But this new detente with Zahi. Well, Zahi was certainly one of the. You know this, don't you? That for years it was really it was a real hostility going on there. He was saying terrible things about us, and I have a very sharp tongue and pen, and I was saying terrible things about him. And at one point he was threatening to sue me, and then there was this strange detente that got set up. And in one of the events that provoked the detente was when Art Bell, in fact, was with. I was on this trip myself, and who else? Graham Hancock and Zahi was on it as well, and Art Bell was on it, and that was one of the events where we started talking to each other, and that initially. Then it was provoked. I'm not sure if that was before or after. I was doing my trips with a guy who I shall go nameless, but he was a real sleazeball, and he was pitching my trips as though they were the mystical snake oil.
Yeah.
I really went up my back, and at one point I decided to break with him. Then I found out he was also ripping me off.
Typical, right?
Well, happened. And anyway... He, in order to get even with me, sent a letter to the tourist board, because technically I'm not supposed to lead trips personally. I mean, I could be on a trip when you go with the academics.
I see.
They lecture in the evening, but during the day you have a regular licensed Egyptian guide. Well, I also have a regular licensed Egyptian guide, and so even though what I do is technically, if they wanted to come after me, which in fact Zahi wanted to do in those early years... They could. Anyhow, this guy put a thing into the tourist board, and eventually it got to Zahi's desk. Zahi called up my very great friend, Mohammed Nazmi, who runs my trips, and the surgeon, we call him, because he knows how to operate brilliantly. He runs the trips beautifully. And he's a good personal friend of Zahi's. And Zahi called him into the office and said, look, Mohammed, I know John... runs his trips with you, and we're not friends, but I'm not in the tourist business, and I'm not going to act on this. So Mohammed called me up and said, this is what Zahi did, and I think when you're here next time, you should thank him. And I said, you bet I should. And the next trip was coming up pretty soon, and so I sort of hesitantly, timorously knocked on Zahi's door and come in, and it was pretty frosty, I said, well, you know, I really want to thank you for that, Zahi, because you didn't have to do that. You could have made a lot of trouble for me. And I said, I really like this war to be over. And he said, well, yes, I would too. You started it. And I didn't argue with it.
You don't want to argue about that. That'll be war two.
And anyhow, one thing led to another, and I said, well, you know, why don't we have a drink or coach and invite you to a dinner or something of the sort. And one thing led to another, and we ended up as, on a personal level, actually, more than just civil, quite friendly, like two knights on the battlefield that bash each other with maces all day long, and if anyone's left standing, they say after, go afterwards and have a beer. And so in public, Zahi is as adamantly opposed to anything New Agey as my stuff is. I don't consider the least bit New Agey. It's backed by scholarship and science.
Sure.
But he's as dismissive of anything that doesn't agree with the academic party line as ever. But on a personal level, he's quite open. And I personally think, when we get into talking about the geology panel that I'm trying to get over there to settle this question of the water weathering once and for all.
Well, I think you're right, by the way. I mean, there's no question, after looking at your work, John, that the Sphinx especially is way older than a lot of people believe.
Yeah.
It might even be older than 10,000 years.
Oh, I think it is, actually. If we get into that, I can explain why I think
sure.
that, because it corresponds to
yes,
the Egyptian texts themselves. I get the sense that it's so unbelievably old that you have to suddenly realize that everything that you've learned about history, in fact, the evolution of the human race is almost certainly wrong but exponentially wrong, not just wrong by a few thousand years. And I think that we may be able to put an actual date on it. But for the moment, the main thing is to simply prove that it is water weathering and that the water weathering is by rainwater. Actually, we've gotten far enough. It's been a long time. You know, this is already 25 years since I've developed this theory, published
sure.
in The Serpent in the Sky. Then Schock got on board in the late 80s. The presentation before the Geological Society of America convention, that was 91. The Charlton Heston Mystery of the Sphinx video was 93. That really broke the story. Well, the conference broke the story because that made headlines across the world. But headlines last only so long. And then the video was viewed and continues to be viewed by millions and millions and millions of people. So that really made it public. But
what about technology, John, during that era? I mean, have you ever approached the possibility that the technology of past civilizations was considerably higher than what so many people think today?
Oh, I mean, this is manifest. This is one of the implications of the Sphinx, of the whole Sphinx theory, the water weathering theory, is that not only is the chronology of history requiring a radical revision, it is, but so what? I mean, you can say, well, what difference does it make if the Sphinx is 5,000 years old or 15,000 years old or 40,000 years old? And it's not even a stupid question. narrow-minded, you might say, but it has its own validity. But if you realize that in redating the Sphinx, what you're doing is, when you take into consideration not just the Sphinx itself, which is unquestionably the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, but it's just sculpture in the sense that if you have hammers and chisels, it's a relatively soft stone, you can carve it. But the temples around it and in front of it are built of these room-sized blocks of stone, some of them weighing up to 200 tons, slotted into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. How they were put there, nobody really knows. And what this means is that there's a technology in place, and since we are a technologically oriented society, I mean, you might
right.
say, practically, there's hardly anybody who wouldn't say that modern science is the crowning achievement of the last couple of hundred years. This is what we call progress. It's mainly, when we talk about progress, we're talking mostly about science in one facet or aspect or another.
Hey, John, when we come back, let's sure. pick that up right from that moment. We're going to take this quick break with our special guest, world-renowned Egyptologist John Anthony West. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on coasttocoastam.com. His website, it's right there at coasttocoastam.com. As a matter of fact, also, you get a glimpse of the cave that I'm broadcasting from when I'm in St. Louis. It's dingy. It's dingy, but it works, and it works well. You'll find it under the Digicam banner up there by feature article. You might have to refresh by hitting F5. Back in a moment. Hey, take advantage of the complimentary double After Dark CD, bumper music, ghost stories, great calls to the show when you order the After Dark newsletter. We just send it right on. You pay a nominal shipping and handling fee. That is it. Call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505 to order After Dark and get the double CD thrown into the deal, or go to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight for the full 3 hours, John Anthony West. John, we were talking about the age of the Sphinx, of course, with the technology of a very ancient civilization. Do you ever subscribe to the possibility that whatever civilization was there that constructed the Sphinx, that they may have gotten involved in wars and they simply blew themselves up or destroyed themselves? Because it seems like there's been a break in the chronology from the moment they built that to, let's say, the modern day Egyptians or the Egyptians of even several thousand years ago.
Maybe. The best evidence for that is not from Egypt, but rather from Vedic India, where in the Vedas there is a description, and one of the things about the Indian culture is that it's still there. If you have a question about the Sanskrit, you can go to your friendly neighborhood Brahmin and ask him to translate it for you, and since he'll speak perfect English, you can get a translation. In Egypt, the language had to be constructed from the ground up, so it's still open to all sorts of interpretation, and it's always being improved and so on. And the description of what appears to be a really physical description of what looks like something like an atomic war. And very often when you get that kind of a description in old legends and myths, they're interpreted symbolically and metaphysically rather than literally, but in certain cases, the literal interpretation looks like it may be correct. On the other hand, you would think, gee, if this happened way back whenever, wouldn't there be some sort of evidence? But maybe not. Because things go back far enough, maybe this is the case. And certainly the legends all over the world, everywhere, and legends are to be taken seriously, and particularly when they corroborate each other, and you have the same myth or legend in Polynesia, and the Eskimos have it, and the Siberians have it, and everybody has it. It's hard to imagine everybody independently coming up with the same kind of story, and there are those stories. The Bible has it, the Old Testament of Sodom and Gomorrah, and of course the flood. So there are indications that catastrophes took place, and I mean that for certain, the physical catastrophes. On the warfare side, or the technological warfare side, the evidence is more tenuous, but there's a certain amount of it there. I think what you can say with assurance now is that there were very, very high levels of civilization that disappeared under catastrophic circumstances of some sort. And that's right. One of the important things what we were talking about before the break was that the technology involved in the temples alongside and in front of the Sphinx is something that we can't reproduce today. And how they did those things is another matter altogether. And this is the important bit, really, rather than the dating itself, because it means that you might say that the reigning religion today is really, even though it doesn't call itself a religion, is what I call the Church of Progress, that we're the most advanced beings that have ever lived on this planet, even though we're in the process of making it absolutely unfit to live in. The notion that the ancients knew as much or more about actual science as we do is something that is deep heresy to the Church of Progress. And so the establishing a new chronology for the Sphinx, particularly if it's a radical chronology, means that we have to rethink the whole way that we look upon past civilization. And this could be something very beneficial for us, because as soon as we stop thinking we're the only smart people that ever existed and that not so very long ago we were just coming down out of the trees, which, of course, we never did in the first place, we're then at least some of us, I hope a lot of us, are obliged to look at our own lives and what we're doing to our beautiful planet in a quite different way. And this could be one of the seeds of real change, because it can't come just externally. You see the global warming and the ravaging of the environment and all of this sort of thing. These are terrible things that are going on. But if it isn't addressed from the ground up in a different kind of way, with a different kind of attitude, it's just Band-Aids over running sores. And it requires more than that. It requires a radical shift of attitude toward our own relationship with the Earth and, in fact, with the universe itself. It requires a different philosophy, and this is one of the things, there are many others, but this is one of the things that could provoke or generate that serious shift of individual and hopefully collective attitude. And that's what comes out of a trip to Egypt, actually. This is the main thing. When people come back from one of these trips, it's rare that people do not say that this was the peak experience of their life, because what they have done is they have experienced a real civilization. What we call progress is almost the antithesis of civilization.
It's got to send chills up your spine when you first saw the Sphinx, John, and the pyramids. It must have been just an unbelievable feeling.
Yeah, it really was, particularly since I had written the whole of The Serpent in the Sky in the library. This was about Schwaller de Lubitsch's work, so I didn't really have to be there. I just had to understand Schwaller in order to write the book. I had to go there in order to develop the Sphinx theory, which is based upon an observation of Schwaller's. But yes, when I finally scraped together the money to get there, when was that, 77 or 78, and stood in front of the Sphinx at dawn, it was an epiphany. I had done all of this work, 6 or 7 years of work writing the book, and then just standing there, and I had this sense of a just an unspeakable antiquity to the whole thing, and a sense of, I rarely get a sense of pride in being a human being, that that people ostensibly like me built this unbelievable thing or carved it. And yes, it was a tremendous experience. Same with the pyramids. And something of that, I still get that when I go to Egypt. Everybody gets it.
Oh, sure.
And then when it's explained via the symbolist point of view that Schwaller developed, I have a line that if you don't see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you don't see Egypt at all. And when you have the experience, and the trip is orchestrated in such a way that the experience comes first, and then afterward comes the talk, and so that you're able to understand the experience. It is literally life-changing, and people come back, in one sense, they come back dissatisfied. They say, what the hell have I been doing with my life all along?
I bet it gets to be emotional. I bet some people have broken down when they... Can you touch the Sphinx? Can you get that close to it now?
Actually, we do, now that I have this... I have this detente with Zahi. We usually are able to get a private session very early in the morning in around the Sphinx. Normally it's off limits, but we usually are able to get in there. I can never guarantee that, but we generally do, yes.
Oh, man,
it's not a question so much of touching it, but of it's different to be in the enclosure and when nobody's there and early in the morning, and yes, you get this hit off it. Well, this is what great art is for. Art is moves you emotionally. It's not an intellectual you can understand. Once you've had the experience, you can then think about it and come to understand the experience. But the experience is emotional. And until you've had the experience, I sometimes say going to Egypt is like sex, because until you've experienced it, you don't know anything about it. So you can talk about it, and you can read about it, and you can look at pictures, but it isn't the same as actually doing it. And that's what happens when people go there and come back. They suddenly look at your individual lives, and then they look at the whole timeline and the rubbish that we're fed about us being these advanced beings with our bobblehead dolls and our Disneylands and our weapons of mass destruction, and you start seeing it in a totally different way. And this makes a difference in people's lives individually and collectively, and that's why it's important. The actual dating of the Sphinx is a nice intellectual question, but it doesn't actually make anything change.
No, is it older, in your opinion, than the pyramids of Giza? I believe you think it is.
Well, actually, I think that the present pyramids may be built when they're supposed to have been built, but they demonstrably, in the case of the second pyramid and the Menkaure pyramid and the Red Pyramid in Dahshur, they're demonstrably built in several stages. So I think that when the Sphinx was built, and even the quackademics, as I like to call them, agree that the Sphinx, the whole Giza plateau, is the single plan from the get-go. So I think that whenever the Sphinx is built, there is something, whether or not they were pyramids or not, but there were something where the pyramids now are. And in the case of the Khafra, the second pyramid, and the Menkaure, the third pyramid, you can actually see, because of the difference of architectural styles that are employed, that it is built in stages. Whenever you see two different, radically different styles in the same building, you know that it's built in two separate stages at two different times. This is part of architectural history. Nobody would disagree with that until you get to Egypt, and then suddenly they disagree with it because it doesn't fit into their paradigm.
Well, when we want to remodel a house, sometimes we'll take an old house. We won't knock it down, but we'll take a lot of the structure apart, and then we'll start to build a new one on the foundation of the old one.
Exactly. Or you leave part of it, and I mean, if you see a medieval tower in the middle of a 18th century manor house in England, you don't think that whoever had the manor house built was an antiquarian who said to his architect, "Look, I really do like medieval towers. Can you put one into my new Georgian mansion here?" No, it's that he is an antiquarian. The tower is there first, and he says, "Let's keep the tower and build a mansion around it." So this is what we have in Egypt in a few places, actually, and it's one of the key pieces of evidence that we use, and in fact we did use, when we had our second presentation at the Geological Society of America's annual meeting back in 2000. Unfortunately, that one was equally successful. The geologists are really almost 100% on our side. There are a few who have a stake in Egyptology who are against us, and this is what we hope to resolve with our geology panel of geologists going over there and duking it out mano a mano on site. This is what I'm trying to have I have a nonprofit foundation. I'm trying to get the funding together to get that going. And I have Zahi's in favor. I mean, he says if I get the panel together and they're reputable geologists, and there will be three from our side and three from his side, and everybody writes papers, and we see if we can resolve this water weathering thing. But Wait, I lost my thread.
Well, while you're doing that, while you're contemplating, all of this,
yes.
I'd ask you about the foundation of the pyramids.
Right.
To me, it's very possible then that what they might have done was dismantle an older structure, but kept the base and built the newer pyramids on top of that.
That's exactly what they did. Especially, you can see that with the Khafra pyramid, the one that's linked by a causeway to the Sphinx. You can see these massive cyclopean blocks that that are used for the lower courses, and then on top of it, the much smaller and rougher masonry of typically Old Kingdom structures on top of it. When you get to the so-called Red Pyramid at Dahshur, the pyramid, the interior of the pyramid, is absolutely perfectly preserved, and then suddenly there's, you come upon, it's hard to describe in so many words on radio. It's when you're there, it makes perfect sense. But there's what they call a plundered tomb chamber, which isn't a plundered tomb chamber at all. It's this ravaged room in the middle of what is otherwise perfect, but the construction is megalithic. It looks like the barrows. It looks sort of like Newgrange in Ireland and certain of the other megalithic constructions. And the stones that are absolutely protected from the outside atmosphere are already pre-weathered in a different way from the Sphinx, but these are stones that have been roughly cut at some point in the distant past and have been out in the weather for a long, long period of time, and then somebody, for reasons of their own, came along and built the rest of the pyramid over it. This is the kind of thing that we'll be looking at with our geology panel once we get over there.
You know, Zahi gets hot under the collar, John, if you say anything of other human beings may have built these structures except the Egyptians. If you don't admit that they were all Egyptians, he does get a little upset, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I never, ever even said that. Even in the serpent, I mean, I used what we now call the A word, Atlantis, but even there I used it carefully between quotation marks, because I wasn't talking about a geographical location. I was simply using Atlantis as a handy word for an ancient advanced civilization that disappeared. So whoever was in Egypt at the time, that's who built the Sphinx. Now, they never said they weren't Egyptians. They were just there much earlier. And when we get accused of trying to steal Egypt's history, it's exactly the opposite. We're glorifying it by saying that here were these people, whoever they were in Egypt, at this much more advanced level than they're given credit for, building these unbelievable things.
So they just happen to be there much longer than we thought they were.
Well, something of that nature, yes. This is the case. But the real lesson is that this takes us quickly into the philosophy and the metaphysics that, to me, a civilization is not dependent upon bobblehead dolls or even upon supersonic dentist drills, though even I, Luddite that I am, would rather go to a 21st century dentist than a 21st dynasty dentist.
Oh, yes, I would too.
Very definitely. But apart from that, in terms of who we are as human beings, that we are on this earth for a reason, actually. And that reason is known. It's enshrined in all of the religions, though you'd never know it nowadays, given the way that most of the people who say they are religious behave. But it really is there. And when you go to Egypt, when you study it, you get a sense of that they once knew what they were here for. And after all, Egyptian civilization is, in many ways, it's a big mystery, because it starts, we're just talking about dynastic Egypt, it starts near its height back in the Old Kingdom, about 2700 BC or so, and then it gradually degenerates until it dissipates and disappears around the time of Julius Caesar and Cleopatra and so on. But it is, after all, it's a civilization that stays intact and recognizable for 3,000 years. I mean, that's half again the period of time from Caesar to us. This is unimaginable to us.
It really is.
When you look at what ours is like, even 100 years ago, it would have been completely unrecognizable to our great-grandfathers, for example. If they saw what was going on now, they'd be absolutely baffled. They wouldn't know what the hell was going on.
So, hey John, stay with us. We're approaching the top of the hour. We'll be right back with you. When we come back, I want to talk about Atlantis, the biblical flood. Maybe that was occurring on the Sphinx. And also get your take on Edgar Cayce's thoughts about the Hall of Records. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with John Anthony West on Coast to Coast AM. And our guest is John Anthony West. Lots to talk about. Hall of Records, what did Edgar Cayce see? Atlantis, the biblical flood. And what was the face on the Sphinx anyway, and what happened to its nose? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey John, is it conceivable that the Sphinx could be 100,000 years old, 200,000 years old, maybe even older?
Yeah, it's conceivable. It could be very, very, very old indeed. And one of the things that I would hope to look into initially, if we get our geo panel over there, obviously, as I said earlier, really, we're going to concentrate on the water weathering. The actual dating of it is a much more complex technological matter requiring samples, and I've learned that that's the S word. You don't bring up the word samples. Eventually, if we establish the water weathering so that the opposition just has to swallow it, mm-hmm. at that point we can start talking about the possibilities of actually putting a date on it, which is not so easy because you can't carbon date stone. There are techniques of isotopic analysis where you test for the decay of radioactive isotopes within the rock, and you need to triangulate. You need two rocks where you know what the dating is, and then rock X, et cetera, et cetera. This is complicated. But eventually, it might be possible to put a date on it, and there's a lot of evidence out there, again, absolutely ignored and dismissed by the paradigm police of the reigning establishment, that says that history goes back way, way, way further into the past. The work of Michael Cremo,
sure,
Forbidden Archaeology, even if he's wrong sometimes, there's 900 pages of evidence there. I mean, I wish that he had simply taken, that it wasn't this 900-page book, but that he had taken 20 or 30 of the bits of evidence that were the most easily substantiated,
right,
and concentrated upon those, because I feel that he's really onto something, and that human beings have been around much, much, much longer than anybody thinks, and at a much higher level, and that this gets us into the whole question of history as cyclical, the Hindu theory of the yugas, and this gets very interesting. I believe you've had Walter Cruttenden on.
Sure.
With the whole idea that the yuga cycle, or at least a cycle within the cycle, it may be a much longer cycle, corresponds to the precession of the equinoxes, the 25,000-plus year cycle. And actually, I don't know if you know this, or when Walter was on, I'm going to be one of the speakers with a whole bunch of other very interesting people in October, called CPAC, C-P-A-K, the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. It's going to be held out in California, and people may be interested in looking that up. There's a website, CPAC, C, capital C, capital P, capital A, capital K, CPAConline.com, I think, or .org. I think so.
Okay.
But that's going to be a very interesting conference looking into this whole question of age and cycles and so on, because those cycles are, and this is something that's really new to my own thing. I knew about those cycles forever, as long as I've been interested in these subjects. But when I came across this notion that the let's say the most graspable cycle was not the millions of years that are accorded it in the usual way that you read about it in Hindu, you know, in the Hindu scriptures, but really was a mistake, or at least, without going into the big song and dance, that it fits within a precessional cycle of 26,000 years, 25,920 canonical number. Then my ears perked up, because that was graspable, and once that's understood, once you take the question of cycles and you understand it, and it's not that difficult to understand analogically, that it's similar, let's say it's called the great year, by Plato called it the great year, and it's relative, it you can compare it to a normal year that we experience. So there's a winter, there's a spring, there's a summer, there's an autumn, and then it starts all over again. And if, use an analogy, for example, the cycle, let's say the shortest cycle that we're familiar with is day and night.
Right.
If you imagine a creature, a fully sentient creature that lives 1 minute, if that creature is born at midnight and it's raining, it can have no idea, unless word has been handed down through myth and legend, what a minute, what a life that lasted a minute would be like at noon and when the sun is out. To extend that analogy to a year, let's say a creature that lives a day, and the day is in February and it's still raining because it lives in Wales, well, that creature can have no idea of what, again, unless the word is filtered down through myth and legend, of what one day of life might be in June in California. It just can't have any idea, and I think that's where we stand in terms of the cycles of history. I'm not sure where we are within the cycle, somewhere around February or March. I think maybe we're at a turning point.
Long way to go. Hey, what was on the face of the Sphinx, John? I mean, was it recarved?
Well, it's definitely been recarved because the head is too small. But what it was recarved from, we absolutely don't know and probably can't know unless somebody comes up with some kind of fantastic Curlian photography that allows you to see what the face once was. Might have been a human being, but it might have been a lion. I think that the Sphinx is a Leo marker. It's meant, whenever it is built, it is meant to signal the ingress into an age of Leo. The last one was about 10,500 B.C. This is the date favored by Bavall and Hancock.
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptians themselves, in their own chronological tablets and papyruses, there's one called the Palermo Stone and another called the Turin Papyrus. Schraller de Lubitsch did a major study of this. They talk about their own civilization beginning somewhere back around 34, 36,000 B.C. Well, that would be the age of Leo before that, and that's the date that I currently think most plausible for the Sphinx. And that's backed up, as I said, by the Egyptian texts themselves. But it could be the cycle before that. But,
well, why did they recarve the face? What do you think happened?
Nobody knows, because we don't know when it was recarved or by whom, at what point. But probably because, this is one of the reasons, because it had been, see, the face doesn't get covered over with sand. The body is terrifically weathered, but once it's covered with sand, it's protected. But the face, which is a harder outcrop of stone, is not protected, so I suspect it was completely ravaged, and whoever it was at whatever period of time decided to recarve it into that particular face, which is actually, as our forensic detective Frank Domingo pointed out, and travelers used to see this all the time when they went to Egypt in the 19th century and said, well, hey, the face of the Sphinx looks like, really looks African, not North African, mm-hmm. but Sub-Saharan right. African. And it does. You look at it in profile, and Domingo, who's the expert, an expert on faces, said, well, yes, it is consistent with that kind of physiognomy. So we don't know, and we probably never will know.
What happened to the nose?
That's easy, actually. It's different rumors that were shot off by Napoleon soldiers and others that it was done by the Mamelukes, who were the Janissaries of the Ottoman Empire, who ruled before that. But in fact, pointed out to me by the loyal opposition, Mark Lehner, that there are Arabic accounts up to about 1200 or so A.D. that talk about the perfection of the head of the Sphinx jutting above the sand. And then around 1400, the accounts start talking about how the Sphinx has been disfigured. So it would appear to be to be the work of an early crop of stupid fundamentalists who are trying to destroy the life of the statue. You notice, actually, this is a commonplace with ancient statuary. Often the noses have been hacked off. The usual story is, oh, well, the statue fell down and broke its nose. What, all those statues fell down and broke their noses? No, it's not. It was understood in ancient times that any statue, was capture the living essence of whoever it was meant to represent. So if you wanted to, if you're a tomb robber or something like that, or whoever that was an enemy, whoever it represents, well, in order to kill the life of the statue, you break off its nose so that it can no longer, let's say, metaphorically or spiritually, breathe. So almost certainly that's why the Sphinx was disfigured, and the date is somewhere around the 13th or 14th century, something like that.
John Edgar Cayce.
Napoleon.
Okay, Edgar Cayce, the late American prophet, somewhat backs up your talk about Atlantis, and he talked about a hall of records being at the base of the Sphinx. This fascinates me. I know people have tried to look for it. I'm not sure the Egyptian government has been very forthright in allowing everybody to look for it. But what's your take on Cayce's trance-like prediction that there's a hall of records there? And if so, what do you think might be in there?
Everybody asks that. Well, our Cayce got his information in trance, but our seismograph doesn't go into a trance. And it certainly found a cavity or cavern or some sort under the left paw of the Sphinx. Now, we firmly believe, myself and Robert Schock, my colleague, and Thomas Dobecki, who was our geophysicist who was doing the actual work with the seismograph, that there is something there, or some sort of a cavern or chamber or something, and we're very certain of that because under the rump of the Sphinx there's a roughly cut chamber. And you know that it's there. There's a block, and you pull it away, and if you have a rope ladder, you can get down into this rough-cut chamber. Nobody knows who did it or when it was done, and it terminates. It goes into a bit of a passageway, which seems to come to a dead end back into the plateau. So, but it shows up on the seismograph loud and clear.
Dimensions? And so, what would they be?
Well, of this one, let's say, 20 by 20 feet, something like that, maybe six
okay.
feet high, but it's right there. But the one under the Sphinx, under the paw,
yeah.
is bigger. It's roughly rectangular. It's about 12 by 15 meters. That's about 36 by 45 feet. And it's under about 5 meters of bedrock. And what we didn't find was any way that you could get into it, because there should be, if it is a man-made chamber, there should be a passageway leading to it.
How did it get below bedrock, for crying out loud?
Well, that's what we don't know. I mean, in other words, if what we're finding is not just a natural fault in the rock, this is what the establishment insists that it is, that it's just a fault of the within the rock. Limestone sometimes has caves in it, but not really this kind of limestone. Anyway, you know, from a practical point of view, there's no point even concerning my head with it, because the first thing is to get our geology panel over there. Afterwards, then, maybe. Now, when you ask what's in it, A, of course, I don't know. How can I know? The Hall of Records thing, the problem is that even if you got down into it, it's now beneath the water level, the water table level. So almost certainly it's full of water. So even if you could drill down in there, people say, well, why can't they just drill a hole with one of those fiber optic cameras? Even if you did that, the chances are you wouldn't see anything, because you'd be putting the camera probably into water, so that if there's anything in there that's dissolvable,
gone, like papyrus or something.
If it's papyrus, but papyrus isn't that old. But if there's anything stone in there, well, maybe, but it's a question that really, there's no point addressing it until we've taken this whole theory a lot further. And if Zahid, people think he's hiding something. I don't think for 2 seconds that he's hiding anything. I think, the truth is that I think that Zahid, though he appears to be really doctrinaire, is at heart less doctrinaire than some of his colleagues, and that if we come back with, if we can really demonstrate definitively that there's no argument that this is water weathering, is not salt crystallization, as they're now saying,
right.
which is absurd, but really is precipitation induced, that it's by rainwater over long periods of time, Zahi will suddenly say, gee, that's interesting, and the work will be allowed to continue. Until that point, it won't be, and there's really not too much point in wondering about what the Hall of Records might be. When you get back to Cayce, you know, his medical predictions really seem to be spot on. There's a lot of documentation for that. But when he gets
very accurate.
Very accurate. When he gets into his other things, his vision of Egypt with his temple beautiful and temple, I forget what the other thing is, just doesn't correspond to what I know of Egypt through Schwaller's symbolist interpretation. And many of his other predictions just haven't come true. California is supposed to be underwater by now. Well, maybe it will be, but it isn't yet. So I don't know. The Casey people, I'm often a lecturer down there, and some of them are really interested in just uncovering the scientific truth, whatever is, let the chips fall where they may. But too many, unfortunately, they're no worse than the establishment scientists who want to preserve the paradigm, and all they're really interested in is seeing Casey vindicated. So,
well, what's incredible, though, John, is the fact that the man would even say that there's something at the base of the foot of the Sphinx. And here you are saying it's possible.
This is true. This is the one thing. And he does say that the Sphinx is much older. The Sphinx and the pyramids are much older, and this mm-hmm. I'm absolutely agreed upon. But a lot of the other things that he, and I forget them, they're not in my head at the moment, but a lot of the other things don't, to me, just don't seem to check out. And even I had dinner or lunch with Casey's, one of the surviving Casey's son. What was, not Hugh.
There's another one named Edgar.
Edward, not the grandson, who I think is in charge now, but he admitted, and he was a lovely and a smart guy. He was an electrical engineer and highly educated, and you know he agreed that that most of the predictions simply didn't have the backup. So I tend to leave. You know, it's not my focus, as it were, and I'm interested in it, but I'm not interested in pursuing it at the moment. I think what's going on there in Bimini, they seem to be coming up with all kinds of interesting new data.
Absolutely. And you're a believer in the Atlantis theory, aren't you?
Well, yes and no. I still, not that Atlantis was necessarily a particular site. In other words, when I use it within inverted quotes, I think that I'm absolutely convinced that there was an advanced civilization and probably advanced civilizations. They may have been global, I don't know, but whether Atlantis was here, Atlantis was there in the Mediterranean or in the Atlantic or whatever, that I'm by no means convinced of. And there's a book that nobody mentions, and even I don't, and I think that was published about the time I was doing my research for The Serpent, and it's a fairly technical book, and then even when I put updates on The Serpent, I didn't put it in there, but it was not because I was deliberately not mentioning it, because it didn't corroborate my own work, but it just didn't occur to me, and it's a book called The Pythagorean Plato by a musicologist and a Sufi named Edward G. McLean. Edward, I'm not sure if I have his first name correct. And anyway, McLean. And in this, he decodes the entire Atlantis myth, and in fact, all of the other Plato dialogues that are concerned with politics mm-hmm. as musical allegories, and that they were intended by Plato as teaching tales to people who were to students who were versed in. Hold on, I got a frog here in my throat.
Yeah, take care of that frog there, John. Got it?
Started out as a tadpole, but it's now grown up to a full-legged frog.
As long as it's not a bullfrog.
Anyway, McLean points out, and he's correct in this, that if you look at the Plato, at the Atlantis myth, it's very specific in terms of how far everything is from everything else and the actual physical construction. Now, if you look back and you realize that this story supposedly came to Plato from his grandfather Solon, who got it from an Egyptian priest, and it's all verbal, it's a very strange thing to know all of this kind of weird detail, that everything was 60 meters long and 40 wide and there were 10 concentric rings and all this sort of stuff. And Plato uses this, and McLean is right.
Stay with us, John. I'll give you a moment to clear your throat, and we'll be back on Coast to Coast AM.
Well, I'm just getting inundated with Fast Blast. People want to talk to and send messages to John Anthony West, so we'll open up the phone lines next hour. And when I come right back, we'll finish up talking with him about the Sphinx and biblical flood on Coast to Coast AM. John, what do you think about the possibilities? Okay, let's say the Sphinx was around 25,000, 35,000 years ago, and then all of a sudden we have this biblical deluge, the flood. Is it possible that that flood caused the erosion that you see on the Sphinx?
Well, yes and no. The erosion on the Sphinx is precipitation-induced. In other words, it is rainwater rather than floods. But how did the floods get there? Lots of rainwater.
Lots of rain, exactly.
So, and when that was, we're not 100% sure. We know that there's some cataclysmic event that produced the melting of the last ice age. Following that, over the space of a few thousand years, the sea levels rose 300 feet, and arguments over how precipitous that was. And something, in other words, it was going slowly, and then at a certain point, it's thought that a huge ice dam broke that kept the glacier, the melting glaciers of Canada and North America, locked up, and then suddenly that broke and scoured out the entire Mississippi Valley, and plunged into the Gulf, and the water levels rose tremendously over the space of however long it takes the water to go around the seven seas, and that could correspond to what eventually became Plato's myth of Atlantis. Actually, just briefly, I'd like to return to MacLean's work, because it's quite clear that this musical interpretation of the Plato Atlantis story in Timaeus and Critias is correct. Now, but MacLean, I think he's still alive. He's older than I am. He must be in his late 80s if he's still around. So I've been told by people who know us both that he's absolutely opposed to the whole notion, to our Sphinx theory and all the rest of it. And I think, so until somebody disproves the water weathering, the Sphinx theory stands. And I think MacLean is both right and wrong. In other words, I think that he's getting this story, Plato is getting this story from Solon as told. And if you look at Plato's myth, at Plato's story, there's only a little bit, a page or so, where he's talking about the sinking of Atlantis, and then he goes into this long-winded description of how big the canals were and all of these numbers, but the numbers crunch out, and what he's doing is he's using the very real historical sinking, or anyway, destruction of a, in quotes, Atlantean civilization, and then turning it to his own uses as a teaching tale that is designed to teach his students, who are musically adept and understand music, of the via the story of disharmony. Atlantis in Plato's conception is a study in what happens under a tyranny. A tyranny becomes unharmonious and ends up in destruction. And so it is a teaching tale, but the basis of it, as far as I'm concerned, with our water weathering theory, is factual. And then, where was Atlantis? Was there a deluge? Well, yes. The sea levels rose 300 feet. Nobody argues about that. And that it's attended by all kinds of destructive things. It's the Quaternary extinctions, all the woolly mammoths and the rhinoceroses and saber-toothed tigers all disappear in a hurry. Siberia, which was temperate, becomes tundra. The North America, which was tundra and locked in ice, becomes what we have today, more or less. Egypt, which was fertile and savanna, is suddenly 6,000 miles across the Sahara Desert. So major things are going on, stretching back to certainly about, I think it's about 12,000 BC was the melting of the ice, and which extended over a few thousand years. So I think some combination of those factors gives rise to the biblical flood, which is, of course, mirrored again, in legends all over the world. And
sure.
For me, whenever I see a myth or a legend that is universal, I take that as evidence that it is based in some way or another upon fact. And actually, in the last 10 years or so, one of the most exciting things about this research, as far as I'm concerned, is that a number of very astute and erudite researchers have been adding to this whole concept of ancient sophisticated civilization from different angles. And most of these books are sort of under the radar screen because they're quite readable, but some of them are pretty technical, but they just haven't made, some of them are even self-published, and they haven't made a major impact. But just to name a few, there's no time to go into all of these. There's a book by a man called Laird Scranton, which was initially self-published but is about to be published by Inner Traditions, called Dogon Cosmology, in which he demonstrates that the Dogon, this little tribe in West Africa.
Oh, and I love
you
this
know about
story.
Those, the Dogon.
Yeah.
Well, Laird you should have on the show, actually. All of these people you should have on the show because they're really interesting. And Laird's book is called Dogon Cosmology, yeah. And in it he shows that the close parallels between Egyptian and Dogon cosmology, but maybe more important, he shows that these are absolutely consistent with contemporary astrophysics, that they are telling the same story, except not in mathematical formula, but in terms of a story that you can tell to children, as it were. But in it are all of the latest wrinkles in torsion theory and string theory and astrophysics and so on. All of this is enshrined in both the Dogon and the Egyptian cosmology. And since writing that book, even though it hasn't had wide circulation, it's been a subject of, needless to say, heated controversy. And one of the things that has come out of it is that people have written in to show that this same cosmology is consistent with the Mayans. It's absolutely written into the symbolism of the Buddhist, the Tibetan Buddhist stupas, the building, the sort of sacred building that they build. And this is the work of an academic with an unfortunate name of Adrian Snodgrass. Written in the, you can imagine the trouble that kid had in school.
Sure, poor kid.
And back in the 60s, he's an architect and a Buddhist scholar. And back in the 60s, he wrote a book called, I think, The Symbolism of the Buddhist Stupa, something standard like that. And in it, even back then, but long before string theory and torsion theory and all of these things, he noted that the story that was being told, the cosmogenesis, the foundation of the universe being told on these Buddhist stupas, which are at least some of them more than 1,000 years old, was consistent with the findings of contemporary astrophysics. And Snodgrass mentions, he says, that it mimics astrophysics. But you can't mimic something unless there's a model for it. There's no such thing as precognitive mimicry. So this is an important study, actually, because it's written in the 60s. So Laird's book demonstrates that a knowledge of astrophysics is what's behind what we consider primitive legends of the Indians and Africans and all sorts of things like that. Somebody way back when understood their physics as well as we do.
Which is incredible.
It is incredible. And that's mirrored, or another aspect of that is studied by a man called a physicist called Thomas G. Brophy, in a book called The Origin Map, in which he looks at the megalithic stone circle in Egypt, Nabta Playa, and finds very advanced astronomy in it. It's in several stages. It's called, what is it, an astrophysical map, something of the universe. It's got a complicated subtitle, but it's called The Origin Map, and that's, again, that's self-published, but you can get it on Amazon. And if Brophy is right, it's in stages. If he's completely right, it means that whenever this was built, and it's thought that it was built about 5,000 BC, which makes it the oldest datable stone circle, but if he's correct, it means that astronomical knowledge, as sophisticated as what we have today in terms of the velocities of the stars and the speed with which they're moving away from the Earth and the size and so on, was all known to the builders of that stone circle. The other book by Richard Heath, who's a friend of John Michel's in England, on one called The Matrix of Creation, and a new one about to come out called Sacred Number, the Origins of Civilization, which decodes, which shows that, particularly this newest book, that, again, from a totally different angle, that this kind of advanced knowledge was known to the builders of megaliths, which are all over the world. It's not just England and Scotland and Wales. There are megaliths all over America. They're in, now it's known that they're in Egypt, that they're in Tunisia and Morocco, all over the place. It'd be interesting to see what happens with this so-called Bosnian pyramid that the archaeologists are busy trying to trash. Shaka's going to go there in July, and we'll take a look at it personally, supposedly.
People are trying to say they're natural. It kind of reminds me, John, of those pyramids that we see in the Sidonia region of Mars. And you've seen those pictures?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Incredible, aren't they?
What?
It's incredible.
Well, it is incredible, but unfortunately, at the moment, we can't get somebody up there to take a look at them. I heard Richard Hoagland the other day, and actually a thanks to Richard for talking about my stuff. I think that was one of the things that generated my appearance right now. I'm not sure. Anyway, you know I don't.
Well, we wanted you anyway, but okay. You're right. Richard did that, and Richard's known you for years.
Oh, yeah. Well, before the, Richard was, in a sense, instrumental in getting our original video on NBC because he introduced us to Robert Watts, who's a major Hollywood producer who got us past the secretaries at NBC and got us on there. But unfortunately, I do follow the whole Mars controversy. Until you get absolutely clear pictures that really that are definitive, you really don't know. And even when you get clear pictures, I know from our own Shock and myself diving the so-called pyramids of Yonaguni underwater and off Japan, Shock and myself are absolutely convinced that these are natural, perfectly natural. No matter how remarkable they look, we can explain the forces that are responsible for forming them. Lots of people refuse to accept that and keep on saying that they're man-made. And I wish they were man-made because it would be the smoking gun that establishes the theory once of an ancient civilization once and for all, because they're deep enough underwater so that if they were man-made, they would have had to have been built prior to the rising of the levels of the seas, in other words, before 10,000 BC. But Chuck and I are convinced. So, but from the pictures, we would never have believed that. It was only when we were in our scuba gear diving and studying it over the course of a week, and Chuck's dived it three or four times, I think. So until you're really there, there's always open, it's always, you don't know. So, yeah, it's interesting, but until something more definitive comes up, I'm open to it, certainly, and I hope they are real.
I would love to get your theory, John, on how you think the pyramids were built.
I don't know either.
If you think 100,000 Egyptians pulled one rock,
well, listen, I'll tell you, I like to go at things systematically. So to me, I've studied this, and I've read all of the tons of things and the engineers who say that you can't do it simply and so on. There are four possibilities which are not, as far as I'm concerned, which are not mutually exclusive. One is that the academics are right and that it is a very simple technology just done with great expertise. And the engineers say, no, you can't possibly do that. But as an analogy, if you put a violin in my hand, I will prove to you that you can't get music out of this device. But you give it to a violinist who spent 30 years studying it, and he gets music out of it. So the fact is that we can't do it this way. The ramp theory and all of these theories simply do not hold up. And if they hold up, if you can move a 2-ton block, well, this doesn't mean you can move a 70-ton block up to the King's Chamber. It just doesn't work out, but it doesn't mean that they couldn't. Second is a hard technology, some sort of machinery that simply we've never discovered. There's no evidence for it. Well, there is no evidence. This is clear. But it could be that something that we don't think is a machine or a device is a device.
True.
For example, if you find a computer 10,000 years from now, and they don't have electricity, they're using some other power source, there are no moving parts. They say, oh, well, it's a religious device. Well, it is sort of. But The fact is they would have no idea that you could store the whole Library of Congress and a couple of chips in that computer. So maybe, maybe there's a technology. They really had a technology, and we don't know what it is, something that we think is a religious symbol, an Ankh or a Jed column or something like that. And it really is something that you can use for construction. The third, which is, I must say, my favorite, is that they have some method. It's a soft technology, maybe music or sound or something of that sort, or that it is done by people in a heightened state of consciousness. Martial arts masters can do things that look physically impossible.
Yes.
And yogis can, too. And so maybe some combination of a relatively simple technology handled by people who are in a higher state, who are trained to achieve a higher state of consciousness, can do these things. That said, back to the primitive one, actually, because I'm becoming convinced that at least later on, when they're moving obelisks and stuff like that around, and you see pictures of them transporting a giant statue with gangs of men on, and the statues on sledges, and they're pouring water or something like that. I mean, it's going along on flat ground. But what you see is what you get. And when you see evidence, even if you don't like it, that contradicts your pet theory, you have to accept it. So I'm inclined to think that certain things that we don't think they could have accomplished by simple means, they did accomplish by simple means, and or some combination thereof. Jury's still out as far as I'm concerned. And the fourth possibility is aliens. And I don't dismiss that because I think I'm convinced the UFO phenomenon is real. But it's my least favorite theory. I prefer to think that it's human beings just like ourselves, but with different priorities and a different system of values and a different
that would explain
strength.
though that theory, John, would explain why we don't have equipment lying around. They
came down, did it, and left. Who would? The alien theory?
Yeah.
Well, maybe, but that's no evidence either. You can't say just because we haven't found the evidence. As I said, why not people in a higher state of consciousness? And you do have pictures of them. You don't have pictures of anyone building pyramids, but you do have pictures of the pharaoh erecting an obelisk all by himself with ropes, and you do have pictures of them transporting gigantic statues on sledges with gangs of men pulling it. So that's evidence. And, yes, it doesn't apply to the pyramids. And how you get those 70-ton blocks up into the king's chamber, I don't know. And how you get the 200-ton blocks slotted into place on the Sphinx and Valley temples, I don't know that either. But the alien hypothesis, as I said, I don't dismiss it. But you can't say, oh, well, it isn't this and it isn't that and it isn't this, because it might be some of those things, and therefore it has to be aliens. That's not evidence either. That's a hypothesis. And as I say, I repeat, I'm not dismissing it. I'm just saying that I prefer the other ones for which there are at least there are people doing it.
Well, you know, remember Edward Leith Scanlon from Coral Castle down in Florida?
Who knows
how he moved those corals?
That's right. And it was just Eddie. He was, you know, he wasn't an alien. He was pretty weird.
No, he wasn't. Magnets, that's it. He knew something about magnetism,
well,
I think, John.
That's right. He thought that he exulted that he had rediscovered the secrets of the ancient Egyptians, but he didn't know that either. He just discovered his own way. Of who knows if the Egyptians had that way or another way. But well, all you can say is that they did it. We don't know why they did it. We certainly don't know how they did it. The perfection of the blocks. Actually, on my last trip, Christopher Dunn was along. Do you know
Christopher? Oh, yeah. The power plant theory.
The power plant. And I think Chris has changed his mind a bit about the power plant, at least in terms of it being an electric power plant. But I think it's an energy device of some sort. And he was there with his fine measuring instruments, looking at the tolerances of stone, and they were the tolerances that you normally apply to a Ferrari, not to stonework. So it's just mind-boggling, and we don't know how it was done. You know, Chris is a believer that they have an advanced technology, but for which there is no evidence. It's a big mystery. And
all right, hey John, you ready for some phone calls?
Oh yeah.
All right, we'll do that when you come right back on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back then. We'll take your phone calls. Our special guest tonight, John Anthony West,
on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're going to take your phone calls now with John Anthony West. John, how will history remember you in terms of your work in Egypt?
I haven't a clue because we're not there yet. But I like to think that I will be one of the people that helps to reestablish the ancient doctrine, actually, what Schwaller de Lubitz called the return to the source. In other words, I hope I'm one of the people involved in or remembered as one who got people thinking about individually and collectively about what we as human beings are on this earth for. In other words, it's really a spiritual lesson. We're here for a reason, and thinking about it isn't going to get us there. It's a certain kind of inner work that is involved in understanding what we're supposed to be doing, which is reconnecting with divine consciousness. I can't think of any other words to use than that. I hate using religious terminology or specific religious terminology if I can help it, because I mean I really don't follow any institutionalized religion, but all of them are, you'd never know it from the way those people behave, but most of them, but are based upon this doctrine that was at a very advanced level in Egypt, that was at once science and at once spiritual, and that is that we have a certain job to do on Earth, and coming to an understanding of symbolist Egypt and everything that is connected with it that I was talking about earlier, all the work of all of these new interesting writers that in the last 10 years, that my work is a piece of that, and possibly a significant piece in the sense that the beauty of the Sphinx theory is that a 10-year-old can understand it. When you get into astrophysics and string theory and the symbolism and things of that nature,
right,
they're complicated and they're not easy to follow.
Sure.
But any idiot can understand what's involved in, or a child can understand what's involved with the water-weathered Sphinx and all of the implications that follow from it. So I hope that lasts.
All right, let's go to the calls. You're in for a treat here, John. Wildcard line, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. My name is Aiden, calling from Camp Springs, Maryland.
Hi, Aiden. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing there?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was around the year 2000, Maury Povich had a special on, I think it was Fox, and it was I taped it, actually. It was real good. And the last segment, they had a thing where they found that the tomb of Osiris, the god of the underworld, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that, as far as information and further insight. And isn't it true that in a previous incarnation, Osiris was Radio Sun God? I mean, Ra the Sun God.
Oh, it's a complicated question. Osiris is, all of the gods of Egypt are to be understood as cosmic principles. They are not beings as such. They represent aspects of the creation and maintenance of the universe. The so-called tomb of Osiris, Zahi calls it that, but really it's a misnomer. It's a very strange tomb under the causeway that leads to the Sphinx. And the top part of it is interesting from my point of view because it's quite severely weathered, and it's underground, you understand. It's quite severely weathered, but different kind of weathering from the Sphinx. And then there are two shafts that go down from there, which are cut almost certainly in late kingdom times, in other words, somewhere around 600 B.C. or so. And those are pristine. You can still see the chisel marks on the walls. And down at the very bottom is a sarcophagus, just the lid. I'm not sure if they managed to get that lid off or not. I mean, it's way down underground. It's 100 and something feet under. You have to go down with a steel ladder. And the shape of that tomb is consistent with late kingdom. There's no, they didn't have tombs that looked, or sarcophaguses that looked like that early, before that time. So almost certainly it comes from that sort of a date. But when he called it the Tomb of Osiris, it would be, under any circumstances, a symbolic tomb, because there is no person named Osiris. And as I said, the gods are to be understood as cosmic principles, and it's the interaction between the gods. In other words, the myth is really science, if you understand it correctly. But told as myth, you can convey it very easily to people who don't have science at their disposal. So it's a misnomer, but it's a very interesting and mysterious tomb of some sort. I don't even know if anybody was actually buried in that sarcophagus way down below, because it's in the water level is now such that the tomb, the sarcophagus itself, is mostly underwater. So it's awkward to get at, and the lid of it weighs tons and tons and tons. And I think, now memory, that Zahi can't get the lid off because it's so deep and it's so perilous. In other words, this thing is going to weigh, I don't know what, 10 tons or 15 tons. And I think they're afraid that it would be very dangerous to try and lift the thing, because it has to be done from way above. I'm not sure of that. But anyway, that's my read on the Tomb of Osiris, which is an interesting place, but I don't see that it has anything to do with Osiris.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Aiden. Does Zahi have complete control over all of the, you know, the Egyptian antiquities, or does he have to go to Mubarak, for example, John, and get approval then?
I think he's the top honcho now. Before, he was the head of the Giza Plateau for years and years and years, but still, you know, sort of like being the police chief of a town. You're the police chief, you're the police chief. You don't have to answer to the governor. And if you're the district attorney or whatever it is of the attorney general, then you don't have to go to anyone. You're answerable, maybe under certain circumstances, to the top guy. But no, Zahi's, and things do go through a panel, a board of sorts. But he's the head of the board, and it's very hard to imagine. I don't know if it happens or not. I don't know the inner workings of the board, but I imagine that he pretty much
runs the show.
He pretty much runs the show. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, he's energetic, isn't he?
He's the man of unbelievable energy. And when you go into his office, he once said, it was funny, when we first were establishing the rapport, we were both giving lecture at the Casey ARE Center down in Virginia Beach, and we were having our first civil breakfast together. And he commented at some point, he said, you know, John, he said, one-third of my day is spent answering emails to people who insult me. it was very funny. But yeah, he's handling four telephones at once. He's an unbelievable energy. And he's doing something the academics are not very happy with him, because he is in a way compensating for 200 years of Egyptian Egyptologists and archaeologists being treated like a bunch of inferiors by the Westerners. And they are now having to come to him on bended knee to get permission to do whatever it is that they want to do. And I don't blame him one little bit. I mean, he's getting his own back for 200 years of subservience, and good for him.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with John Anthony West. Hi there. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah. Yes. Go ahead. Well, can't keep them if they don't talk. West of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is David. I've been on two trips with John. As a matter of fact, I was on the trip when he was mentioning Christopher Dunn.
Oh, that's David. Hello.
Yeah, how you doing?
Where have you been?
I haven't emailed you in a while.
I know.
But it was truly spectacular on that trip to watch Christopher Dunn measuring. Remember, John, we were out on the Giza Plateau?
Yeah, sure.
And he had a ruler that was honed to within 1/200th of an inch or something like
that. Oh, no, it was much finer than that. It was a 10,000th or 100,000th.
Right.
It was unbelievable.
Oh,
and it absolutely followed this piece of stone that to anybody who was just walking by would think it was just a throwaway stone. And it was truly amazing. But I've been listening to you, and one of the things I want to say is I have been on two trips with John, and Egypt is truly remarkable, and it's an amazing experience to go to Egypt with John Anthony West.
What is it, David, that fascinated you the most when you went on the trips with John?
I think it really is looking at it from the symbolist viewpoint, that these things were done. Whatever they were done for, it was done for a real purpose. And the thing that's so special about John is he tries to show you Egypt, not just, he said something very funny. You watch all the tourists out there, and a guy goes, well, that's Osiris, that's the queen, the column is 9 meters high, let's move on. And it really is much more than that. For instance, we were in the Sphinx enclosure, and we were able to get right up next to the Sphinx and watch the sun rise and the first light of the sun hit its face. And that is an experience, other than just talking about the weathering and everything, it's an experience you will never, ever forget.
Just trying to picture ancient Egyptians or people witnessing that a long time ago, too, is got to be something. Thanks for the call. Wasn't the Sphinx deeply under sand up to the neck of the head,
yeah.
John?
Oh, sure. I mean, periodically, even since Egyptology began around the time of Napoleon, if you don't sweep it out every couple of weeks, you'd leave it within 15 or 20 years, it's back up to the neck in sand again. So, and you can calculate within broad limits that since it's supposedly built 2500 BC, that's 4500 years, around 3000 of those years it's been buried in sand. So how did it get weathered the way that it is? I mean, this is part of the stupidity of the quackademics.
And do you think it was buried all the way over its head?
No, it definitely
couldn't even
isn't
see
the head.
It?
The head is probably what determined the building of the Sphinx in the first place. It's what's called a yardang. It's a harder outcrop of stone that would have projected out from the surface of the plateau. But the surface of the plateau itself, this is one of my questions that I want to put to our geo panel if we get over there. The surface of the plateau itself may have been itself worked. In other words, Chinese style, feng shui. It may not be the natural actual plateau formation, but in any event, the head of the Sphinx is a much harder outcrop of limestone, and it would have projected above the level of the plateau anyhow, and then at a certain point, somebody came around and said, well, let's turn this into a Sphinx, and dug all of the stone out from around it, used those stones to build the temples adjacent and just to the south of it, and that's how it was built. What the motivation was for building it, that's another matter. We go into this, actually, George, we go into this, I didn't mention this, but in our new, and I think quite spectacular, DVD series, Magical Egypt, The Symbolist Tour, which is 8 episodes long, we go into this at some length. Did you get that? We sent you a set.
You know what? It's probably on my desk in Los Angeles because I popped over to St. Louis for Father's Day, and I'm going to stay just a couple weeks.
I'll bet it is, yeah. Because we go into a lot of the things that I've been talking about in this, and my partner in this, a man called Chance Gardner, is an absolute graphics genius. These things look like nothing you've ever seen before. Actually, it's on. There's a website, magicalegypt.com. And you don't have to buy the whole set. You can get them separately. But they're really, a lot of these things that we've been talking about, we go into in depth in the series. And it's an ongoing series.
I look forward to that. Okay, East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is Mike calling from Tennessee.
Hey, Mike. Go ahead, sir.
A quick question for John, please. I've heard a lot of your previous experts on the pyramid saying that the mathematics are so correct that you can find the interior of a circle even in the mathematical equations of the pyramid. but yet I hear that, saying that all this was created and built before the invention of the wheel. Now, I wanted to get his take on that. How could an ancient civilization have been so advanced and yet bypass something as basic as the wheel if they can actually derive these circular measurements from those computations?
Actually,
did I make my question clear enough? I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, I think I understand what you're saying. Actually, they did have the wheel. They had the potter's wheel from time immemorial, but they didn't use it for transport. And actually, when you go to Egypt, you see why, because they've got the Nile. Everything that they need goes up and down the Nile, and they don't have roads because you almost couldn't build roads in the areas that are subject to the annual Nile flood. So, and for transporting stuff over land, particularly when you're dealing with very heavy blocks, as they were often, the sledges being pulled work better than wheels. They had wheels,
sure.
All right. Early on, when then, of course, later on, they have chariots. You've seen the Tutankhamun chariots. But early on, they certainly do have the potter's wheel. They just never use it for the things that we think you would use wheels for.
Can you imagine just when we talk about the dawn of civilization, John, how many things have occurred in Egypt? I mean, you know, we got Cleopatra, Mark Anthony, the pyramid. I mean, so much history is in that region. It really is something.
Well, yes, actually, when we get to Cleopatra and Mark Anthony, we have a pretty good idea of the real history. But the earlier you go, the more tenuous the history becomes. And there are these big, giant books on Egyptian history as though they knew who these people were and who these characters were, and Ramses II was this great egotist. When you look at it closely, even a couple of the academics acknowledge that it's Gardner who wrote the great grammar. Sir Alan Gardner says the Egyptian history is a bit of rags and tatters. It's all stitched together with conjecture. It's not till you get to about, really, to the time of the Ptolemies that you actually have records of what Egypt was like. And of course, a lot of this stuff must have been, or probably was, in the Alexandria Library, and that got pillaged and everything disappeared except for apparently a few of the ancient maps and stuff like that. So really, there's certainly a lot of history there, but we don't know that much about it. And even some of the battle scenes are more apt to be, a lot of them are quite clearly not real battle scenes, but rather symbolic battle scenes between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and yet sometimes they may be real battle scenes. They're very vivid. So when it comes to the history, that's another rat's nest, a labyrinth of controversy.
And even the story of Moses, another great story.
Oh, this is the story of Moses. There's you can't document Moses historically, no matter that it's the central. It's the central story of the Old Testament. There really is no documentation to substantiate a Moses or an Exodus. There's a good book written, I forget the title of it exactly, by Donald Redford, who's a very well known Egyptologist. That there's no physical evidence for it, and in fact, the Moses story itself is remarkably reminiscent, not quite identical to the part of the Isis and Osiris myth of Horus being raised in the papyrus swamp. So it's much more liable to be mythological and cosmological than it is to be physical and actual.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. Final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. If you want to try StreamLinking, all you have to do is go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at it. I think you'll enjoy it. It's just pennies a day. A lot of people are podcasting now, too, where the complete show is just popped right down, and they're able to listen on their iPods in the morning. It's fascinating. So we'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with our fascinating guest, John Anthony West, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with John Anthony West and your calls. And so many of you continue to call, so we'll go right to the phones. Wildcard line, it's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, this is Carl from Milwaukee. I'd like to ask John a question regarding, has there been any signs of weathering on any other structures, specifically the Step Pyramid in Saqqara?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. Well, the Step Pyramid, once it's, you can't really, you know, in other words, the outer casing has been stripped away, so the core masonry is weathered, but in an altogether different way. However, there are lots of instances of water weathering. Specifically, if you're asking that question, yes, around the Giza Plateau, in words over the radio, hard to describe. There's a tomb, supposedly the tomb of Khenkaus, who was one of the queens of Menkaura, the builder of the third pyramid. But yes, there's lots of other evidence. There are weathered shafts in Saqqara that are part of the puzzle, and this is the motivation of the whole idea of our panel of geologists, is to get these guys out there, three on our side and three on their side, and confront the evidence, and then everybody discusses it in depth, and then people write papers and let the chips fall where they may. But yes, there's loads of evidence. That's what we presented at the second GSA meeting in 2000, again, to a packed house of geologists, all of two of whom but said, yeah, you guys must be right. So yes, there's loads of stuff, but there isn't the time, and it's meaningless, because we're trying to describe in words these things that are not spectacular. Everyone knows what the Sphinx is and how it looks, but to try and describe what a water-weathered shaft looks like is
that's
next to impossible. Good question.
The reason I asked that question is the builder of the pyramid, the pharaoh Zoser, had also down the river an obelisk that had mentioned a famine. It sounds very familiar to the Joseph story. And I was thinking, well, he's in the third dynasty, and then the Ramses, supposedly, who was supposedly put together with Moses, is somewhere in the, is it the 18th dynasty or the...
Yes, 19th, yes.
19th. And I always wondered about that, and it certainly stretches that timeline.
The whole thing of the Israelites' captivity in Egypt has no... It's strictly from the Old Testament. There is no Egyptian account of that, but that doesn't mean that it's not true. It's just that, you know, there's very little Egyptian real history. But even that story of Zoser shows up on a stela, I believe, in Philae, where it talks about that, but it's not cut in Zoser's time. In other words, it's a story about Zoser. But yes, it is very reminiscent of the Joseph story, but it's not carved by Zoser himself. So you've got another problem to deal with there. And as I said, there's little or no documentation to back up most of those biblical Egyptian correlations until it gets much, much further into Egypt around the time of Nebuchadnezzar and 5600 BC, as it were. Even the David and Solomon stories, which everyone accepts as factual, have, unfortunately, practically no historical documentation, which, as I said, doesn't mean they're not true. It just means that you can't document them.
If you were in a time machine, John, where would you go? Would you go back to the moment that they were building these structures?
Might be fun, yeah, to go back to when they're doing the Sphinx. You bet. Yes, I think I might.
Ask the builders? Let's assume you pop up in a time machine.
Yeah.
There they are, building the pyramids or building the Sphinx or carving it. Well, what would you talk to the builders about?
Well, I would say, what are you doing this useless stone thing for? Well, you could build a Walmart here. Come on, guys. No? How about it?
And they'll say useless. It's our spacecraft.
Well, or something. Well, it's really, you know, what the temples do right from beginning to end. The Sphinx also. This is what art is supposed to be about. It's not about self-expression. It is about connecting us with our source. It's as simple as that. And when you go through Egypt, this is one of the reasons why Egypt is so important. I mean, there's not, see, in America, which is so recent, there's almost no sacred architecture in the sense that there is in in Egypt, or even in Gothic, you know, however rough and crude things were in medieval times, boy, you walk into the Cathedral of Chartres early in the morning sometime, and you know that somebody knows something and somebody knew something, no matter how much they didn't know. Somebody knew something very important, and that's what Egypt really is about. So Gurdjieff says the Sphinx is the symbol of an esoteric society, and when you see it, or the regular temples, which are much, much later than the Sphinx, you walk into them under the right kinds of conditions, and you get this emotional wallop that normally you'd only get out of the best music, out of Bach or Monteverdi or Beethoven's late quartets and things of that nature.
You
so,
know, if that,
but yeah, I'd like to be back there when they're building those things, you bet, especially Sphinx Age.
If an asteroid wipes us out and, let's say, a few of us kept civilization moving ahead, 100,000 years from now, 200,000 years from now, if these humans were to see Mount Rushmore, what do you think they'd say? You know, they'd see these faces up there.
They laugh because they know that those are faces of non-entities and nobody cares. Actually, not true. Washington and Jefferson weren't bad. Teddy Roosevelt was a bit of a nutcase. And who else is on there?
Who's
the fourth one?
Isn't it Lincoln?
No, Lincoln and Washington, and who else? Who else is in there?
There's Lincoln, Washington, there could be Jefferson, and like you say, Teddy. I'm going to have to check that now to make sure
Teddy's
I'm right.
Teddy's a bit of a nutcase. But, I mean, they would recognize it as secular, and this is not what you get when you go to Egypt. There's a very different emotional quality to it, unmistakable.
West of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Bobby from Oklahoma City.
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, I was just going to tell you, it's a good show. You're really unveiling the riddle of the Sphinx, you know? And I was just going to tell you, you know, when you said that thing about that it, you know, represented Leo, you know, that's the oldest symbol, that Sphinx and pyramid, and that's the symbol of man as his infinite power next to that pyramid, the base up to an infinite point. And that's just an esoteric statement, and it's very basic. And that Edgar Cayce... discovery, that's what happened, is really a metaphor for we as a society are going to, with no hang-ups, you know, get in with that Sphinx energy, you know, to where we're all powerful, infinite beings that are just sitting there chilling, just like the Sphinx. And I was going to ask you if you knew of any Egyptian paintings or steles that might have a picture of the Sphinx with the old head, like you had any suspicions of
that? No, definitely not. In fact, the Sphinx isn't even mentioned, the Great Sphinx isn't even mentioned in Egyptian texts until 1,000 years after supposedly it was built. In other words, it only shows up in New Kingdom times, and it's only in the New Kingdom that they start creating other Sphinxes, you know, with the Hatshepsut and Amenophis the Third and so on. So it would appear that the Sphinx was even a mystery to the ancient Egyptians themselves, the real Sphinx. So, yeah, no, there's no representations of it until much, much later, and then it's never the Great Sphinx. It's other Sphinxes that are used as the guardians of the horizon and things of that nature.
John, we are correct, by the way.
What?
The faces of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln are up there at Mount Rushmore. So we got it.
Let's hope the present incumbent doesn't join them.
First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, John. It's Dwayne calling from Toronto.
Yes.
Earlier you were talking about the fantastic, unbelievable stone carving in the Sphinx Temple out front.
Yes.
And just the curves and the way the rock fits together. It's. I was there a while ago, and it's... an unbelievable experience just to sort of see how that kind of stonework could even be done then, much less could we do it today. I wanted to bring attention to, and maybe you could comment on the similar stone structure that's behind the Abydos temple.
Oh, the Osirion, yes. Yeah. Well, that's part of the same puzzle. The Osirion is stylistically similar to the Valley Temple. And we feel that that's a big part of the that's corroborating evidence, but maybe not of the Sphinx era. See, the Valley Temple
where you see all of that granite work, is the second stage, and it's always called the Valley Temple of Khafra, but frankly, I don't even think that that is the work of Khafra, those of the Second Pyramid. I think it's a still earlier stage, maybe corresponding to the Egyptian texts themselves, where they talk about a long period when Egypt is ruled by divine king, by the gods themselves, which I take to mean rulers who have achieved the personal immortality. And then another long reign where Egypt is ruled by the semi-divine kings called the followers or the companions of Horus. And it may be, this is conjecture, but it's based upon some evidence that the Osirion is dates from that second pyramid. In other words, that it replaces something that's there before, because the Valley Temple, all those granite columns, those are definitely add-ons, because the original temple is built from the blocks quarried out to form the core body of the Sphinx, those gigantic limestone blocks, and they've been faced with granite, and that's a later stage of construction. So, yes, there's a connection, we feel, between that and the Osirion, but even if we get the geopanel together, that would be, we wouldn't have time or the money for it to do it all in one fell swoop, but if we get the water weathering theory definitely established, at that point we can start getting more ambitious and looking to do more detailed work and maybe get the seismographs back and all that sort of stuff. What we need is a friendly billionaire to put some money into my Ancient Wisdom Foundation so that we can carry out all of the whole bunch of projects that I've got.
How much
in my
do you
head.
Need, John? How much Pardon? Do you need just to, how much do you need to get rolling on something?
Well,
like
on
that?
The geo panel, actually, I've got something like about 2/3 of it pledged already. We need the geopanels around $120,000, which is, you know, by standards of particle accelerators and anti-missile systems is peanuts. But some of the other things, the more complicated work of seismographs and all of that sort of stuff. But that's for the future, right? At the moment, we need $40,000 or $50,000. But really, I'd love to get the thing funded well enough so that we can actually have a couple of salaried people as an in-house Egyptologist, as a friend of mine who
ongoing.
So that there's somebody that you can really go to and say, well, look, we need research on this, because, you know, at the moment, I mean, it's just me or my colleagues, and we're all so busy, and we're all just, most of us don't have much money. So there's never anybody that you can turn to. If you're, you know, if you're in the academic community, you've got a hot and cold running graduate students that you can say, look this up, and somebody disappears into the libraries for a couple of weeks and comes up with the information that you need. So, yeah, so getting
has
the... Getting
anybody
the,
approached Bill Gates?
A number of people have suggested that, and in fact, somebody told me just the other day that he had it on very good authority that both Gates and, is it Paul Allen?
Paul
are,
Allen, his
are
yeah,
seriously his. Interested in Earth mysteries and things of that nature.
Well, Paul Allen funds the SETI project. Did you know that?
Yeah, but that's different. You know, that's not.
Yeah, but he came up with $15 million for that.
I know, but that's not spiritually oriented, and it's a different matter. See, I mean, there's nothing heretical about SETI, but what we're doing is very definitely heretical. It runs counter the establishment, and. But anyway, I have heard that these people are very interested in that. But the problem with, they're besieged by people who are after them for money for a jillion different reasons.
Oh, true.
You
got to get to them.
Getting
yeah.
past the secretaries and the guardians is the big problem. And again, it's just me and in my case. And, you know, there are no grant writers and there are no, and going through that process, you know, you meet them at a party somewhere along the line and can actually get to talk to them, then you can make a case. But otherwise, getting to those people who have the wherewithal and sometimes even the interest to help is the tough bit. And I've never been able to solve how you go about doing that. And, you know, I'm not about to just sort of go with my cap in hand and spend the next of the year trying to knock on people's doors. I've got other fish to fry. I just can't do it.
Wildcard line, your turn. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Jason from Indianapolis.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for holding so long.
Not a problem. This is more kind of like a theory. Because you mentioned earlier, John mentioned earlier, he was talking about how they have the blocks and that it shows them pouring water and such like that in front of it. And with just how, within the past couple decades, how many plants and animals have gone extinct or vanished from the face of the earth. And like I said, this is just a theory, but who's to say that there wasn't some plant or combination of plants that they had, that they made some sort of very slick lubricant that they were actually pouring in front of these giant blocks? Because, I mean, oil and everything else, just from what we can make now, can be so slick that anybody...
Oh, we lost you right there. Uh-oh. Let's see if you had a gist of what he wanted to say there.
I can do it. Actually, it's a good question, but in fact, just slick mud. I mean, they're pulling these sledges along on the shows and pulling them along on flat surfaces, and just slick mud, as the quarry masters will tell you, has a very, I know whatever it's called, coefficient of friction. It's not as good as oil, but it's as near as damn it, and you have hundreds of trained men pulling these giant statues along on sledges. You don't need any other lubricant. It's just water will do it well enough. And again, when the evidence is in front of your nose in Egypt, what you see is what you get. And you have hundreds of guys pulling a sledge with a huge hundreds of ton statue on it. You can be pretty sure that that's how they moved it. Now getting, as I said, that's one problem. Getting 70 ton blocks up a ramp 200 feet in the air and putting it into place in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid so that you can't put a piece of paper in between the blocks, that is another matter. So just because, serious, because certain technologies work up to a certain capacity, and then over that capacity an entirely different technology is required.
They had some kind of technology, John, that we don't have.
They had something that we don't have.
Absolutely, and that is I think for the ages for us to try to find out, because that could be the secret of the entire past civilization of this planet.
Well, maybe it may be, but meanwhile, the important thing is the doctrine. Actually, is the teaching that we're here for a purpose, whether we figure out what the pyramids are for or not.
You were right about that. Hey, John, thank you for being on the program. We got the clock. All right, my friend. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. That was a fascinating program. Until then, be safe, everyone.